one of the things I'm working very hard on is to emphasize the community aspect of what we do. That when you come to a concert, you come because of the people. You know, because otherwise, why? You know, you could stay in your house. You don't have to deal with the person next to you who's coughing. You don't have to deal with the person who smells bad next to you. Basically, if you stay at home with your fancy sound system, you get to do whatever you want. So why would you go to a live concert? Well, I think it's because of all the other people. Because when you put everyone in that room like that, and you are visually and viscerally connected to what is going on stage, that's where these incredible transformative moments happen.
What's up, everyone? Welcome back to the Austin Meyer Podcast. I'm your host, Austin Meyer. I am a documentary filmmaker, photographer, and on this show, I interview the world's best storytellers in all sorts of genres about how they craft the stories they tell. This week on the show, my guest is symphony conductor Francesco Lecce-Chang. Francesco is currently the music director for the Santa Rosa Symphony in Northern California and the Eugene Symphony in Oregon, where he has been dedicated to innovative programming, commissioning new music, and engaging in community outreach. Described by critics as a, quote, fast-rising talent in the music world with the real gift, unquote, he has appeared with orchestras around the world, including the National Symphony, Atlanta Symphony, Pittsburgh Symphony, Toronto Symphony, St. Louis Symphony, and Hong Kong Philharmonic, while collaborating with renowned soloists such as Renee Fleming and Itzhak Perlman. And in 2019, Francesco also conducted the San Francisco Symphony and the New York Philharmonic. As someone who grew up going to the Santa Rosa Symphony with my parents, this was a special conversation to have, because not only did it give me a deeper appreciation of classical music, but it reframed some of the ways that I'm thinking about how to lead a creative group in pursuit of compelling stories and creating compelling art. In this conversation, Francesco and I discuss what is wrong with the classical music industry and how he is trying to address it, leadership principles to get the most out of a creative team, and why the Symphony Music Hall is and will remain a unique and sacred place for building community. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Francesco Lecce-Chang. Francesco, thank you so much for joining the Austin Meyer Podcast. We are here in your beautiful backstage office. Will we call this an office?
It feels like an office, especially with this big like conference table we've got here.
We've got a conference
I've never
table.
Had a dressing room where I could have an entire conference table and a grand piano in a room.
So do you use the grand piano in your office? And if so, what do you use it for?
Yeah, I mean, I was trained as a pianist, so it is, it's great to have it here. Honestly, because I travel so much now that I don't get to practice as much as I would like to, so it's nice to know I have this instrument here. But it's helpful if I'm trying to, like, work things out, like, on the piano, like, how some, like, a certain melody or something in the music that I'm trying to figure out. But probably most useful when I have singers, so I can coach them, and, you know, it's just good to, you always kind of have to have it.
So you'd bring them in here and then work through their part on the piano.
Exactly.
Okay, gotcha. So, yeah, you mentioned you're traveling a lot right now. So can you kind of paint the picture of what the lifestyle looks like for you and maybe kind of talk about whether that's common for conductors? What does it look like?
Yeah, it's everybody, I think, has kind of their own way they try to figure it out. I mean, there are conductors I know that live entirely out of suitcases and they just hop from place to place. I think I've always, I always knew right away when I went into conducting, I didn't want to just be a conductor. I wanted to be a music director, which meant I wanted to anchor myself to an orchestra and to a community and actually like enact long-term change and not just like come in once a year or just bounce around constantly. And so I've been lucky that I get to do that in two places, in Eugene, Oregon, and here in Santa Rosa. And so, fortunately, there are two orchestras that are, you know, an hour flight away. So I'm lucky in that regard. I know conductors that have two orchestras, you know, on different continents.
Yeah.
And I can't, honestly, now that I know what this feels like, I can't imagine what that is like, because it really keeps you... you know, you're just jumping back and forth. And I don't like staying in hotels. So, you know, I have a little place here and I have a slightly bigger place in Eugene where I can keep my stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And my fiance works as a harpist in Miami.
Oh, okay.
So I have a lovely triangle around the U.S. right now that I frequent. And then, of course, you know, anywhere else you get hired to conduct. I was in conducted the New York Phil in November.
Congratulations. So, that's
yeah,
exciting.
Yeah, that was cool to kind of get out there. And I'll be in Knoxville this spring. So,
okay.
Kinda, you know, whatever little projects show up on your radar.
Yeah.
But yeah, you spend a lot of your time on the road. And to be quite frank, after, you know, what have I been doing this for? Like, this kind of lifestyle kind of just happened very quickly for me, probably in the past 2 to 3 years. So I'm not quite sure how much I like it yet.
Yeah.
It's certainly stressful, you know.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, because so I just came back in mid-January. I was at something called the National Geographic Storytellers Summit, and I was there as a documentarian, and I'm early career, but I see all these people who are like the top in their fields, whether that's photography, filmmaking, and it's really easy to idolize what they do if you just see like the photos that they show or the photos that come in the magazine. But only now that I'm starting to get into the world, I start to like think about, okay, what does that lifestyle entail? And do you know whether like there are a lot of conductors who like as they grow in their career and get older and priorities change, do a lot of people burn out from that lifestyle?
I don't think so. I think there's a, at least I don't actually really know any musicians that have sort of, well, it happens on occasion, but none that I can honestly think of off the top of my head. I think the drive is so strong to get to this point in like our careers in the music world. I mean, it's so competitive, and you kind of, it's very easy to feel isolated. Mm-hmm. And so you push yourself so hard. And I think that kind of innate drive doesn't allow you to ever kind of stop. And
right.
I think you can shift how you do it. And that's kind of what I'm trying to figure out is setting aside time where I'm not going to work, where
yeah.
I'm going to take some time to myself. And, you know, these are important things that I'm learning about how to deal with. You know, how do you plan your time? You know, what time of day, you know, are your flights going to be so that you don't, you know, that you're not stressed out even when you arrive in a place? And like, you find these little kind of life hacks, I guess, if you will,
yeah.
that makes life living life on the road a little bit, easier. But it's definite, like you said, it is not as glamorous as I expected. I still remember the first time I got, you know, like the, what do you call it? You know, my first status with an airline company for
yeah,
all the
right,
flying.
Right, right.
And I was like, oh, this is so cool. And like within 2 months, I realized that it's like a consolation prize. It's like, we're sorry that
yeah.
you have to live a life like this. You know, here's a free check bag for you. And I was like, okay, this actually is really sad.
Why was it important for you to be a music director and not just a conductor? And maybe you can go over what that delineation
yeah,
means.
Absolutely.
In your head again.
Yeah. So, I mean, a conductor might have a position like principal conductor with an orchestra, but most usually it's like a guest conductor. So like when I was, you know, went to New York Phil or, you know, San Francisco Symphony or, you know, whatever orchestra that I'm in with for 1 week, you're basically the guest conductor. And so your only job is to conduct the orchestra. You know, you have 4 rehearsals usually and the concerts, and that's all you're required to do. You know, maybe an interview, maybe a quick video shoot, but essentially the contract says you just conduct the rehearsals and the concerts and you're gone.
Mm.
You know, so you might fly in on a Monday and you're gone by the next Monday.
Okay.
And that's a guest conducting week. So when you're a music director, means that you're actually going to have a position in an organization, that they don't just contract you for 1 week, but actually it's a quite a long and very vigorous process that goes into choosing a music director, because that's kind of the long-term artistic vision of an organization. And in many ways, the smaller the orchestra, the more important the position is. You know, because with, you know, a large orchestra, they might have 80 people on staff. Here in Santa Rosa, we have, I think, like 11 or 12.
Right.
So my position is very, very important on an administrative end, just to kind of, because everything can't be done for me. I need to actually be a part of the team to make things happen. And I like that part. The thing about being a music director is you have to be willing to Well, you have to be willing to do the administrative work, but I think you also, you have to have the drive and that long-term vision. And I think that's what pushed me into that area. Mm-hmm. Because in some ways, the negatives are, I don't do music all the time. You know, I would say, honestly, maybe it's probably like a third of my life is studying scores and conducting, and two-thirds is... development, outreach, community work, education, planning, all the things that I have to have my hands on constantly. Like, that actually takes up more time than just like studying scores and conducting the orchestra. That can be a downside. And I know a lot of my colleagues that get really frustrated because, you know, they get their first music directorship. They're so excited, and frustration quickly sets in. And so it's definitely not for everyone. You can be a great conductor who is not a great music director, or doesn't want to be a music director, and that's fine. But I've always been a big idea kind of person, and I think my whole life was always wanting to interact with people. And ever since I was like a young musician, young pianist, I was always forming chamber groups, and I loved playing in youth orchestra, and I was a composer, violinist, violist, clarinetist, and pianist. So I was doing like everything I could in high school. Like, I was so involved in like every area of music. Yeah. But ultimately, I just loved people. I love interacting with them, and I love building community. I think kind of the natural, what is required of a music director fits really well with not only my skill set, but just like what my priorities are. And so that's what's been so important, being here, is being able to do things that you can't do as just a conductor, right. And so this weekend that we're here, we're giving the world premiere of this brand new, 35-minute, 5-movement symphony. And it's not only just one symphony, but it was right after I got this position here in Santa Rosa on top of my orchestra in Eugene. And I decided, well, with two orchestras, I want to do something spectacular. Like, if I have been given this incredible opportunity to have two orchestras, I don't want to just collect another paycheck. I want to do something really different. I want to do something that I couldn't have done with just one of those orchestras.
Okay.
And so part of that was saying, what are we missing right now in the music world? What we're missing is it's not a dedication to new music. Lots of orchestras are committed to new music. It's kind of the cool thing to do right now, which is a good thing for all of us. but we're not really risking anything. So a lot of orchestras, like when we commission new music, it's always like, there's like an extra component to it. There's like a famous soloist attached to a new piece, or it's a multimedia piece. Like, there's video or something with it. Or maybe there's even just like, it's like a social cause. Like, maybe it's a piece about some controversial issue.
Gotcha.
And, so something to make it pop, right? And something to make it sell. And what we don't really do anymore is just ask composers to write good music. Mm-hmm. We don't trust them anymore. And it's a problem, and it is scary, but ultimately that's how 300 years of orchestral music was developed, was composers being allowed to give us their artistic visions of what they think music can sound like, and the storytelling that you can do through music, because it has changed so much over the centuries. It would be silly to stop now. And yet we sort of have, it sort of stalled. I mean, you can ask anyone, name a work titled symphony written in the 21st century. I mean, I can't name one. I know there are, but they're sporadic, they're spread out. Some of them don't even get performed, and especially in the US, it's just not a thing right now. And so it doesn't mean there's not new music being commissioned, but there's always something attached to it. You could never go to the NEA or a foundation that's supporting new music and say, we would like to commission this composer who we believe in to write us a great piece of music. That will never get you any money. There always has to be something.
So how did you do it on this one?
So I privately fundraised, which I think says a lot about this community and this orchestra, that I was supported. And this is even before I had conducted my first concert as music director.
You just got in. You're like, hey, everyone.
Yeah, everyone. I have an idea. And I think we should commission a symphony, of course, the funny part was, I was like, well, not just one, though. I want to commission 4 symphonies over the next 4 years from 4 different composers.
Good for you.
Because that's the only way to generate enough interest to really make orchestras look at what we're doing and say, why aren't we doing this? Because that's the conversation I want to start, is if we're able to do this, like these two orchestras are able to do this, it means anyone can do it. And so, I kind of took what I told you just now as the premise for why this is important and how we're driving the art form forward. And I mean, I was the first person to kind of put my money in the pot to make sure I could tell people when I went to donors to fundraise and say, I believe in these four composers I've chosen so strongly that I want you to join me in supporting this project. And so I was able to, so I privately fundraised from four households here in Santa Rosa and four households in Eugene. And so basically the nine of us donors all came together over the next 4 years to support and commission these four symphonies.
Amazing.
And, you know, it's been, but that's only something that a music director could do. You know, only in my position could I create that kind of long-term vision and actually make it happen and see it through.
And what goes into those composers having built that trust with you? What is it that has made you believe in them so much that you're willing to throw your own money and reputation as you come into a music directorship behind them?
It's an excellent question. It's a really good question. You know, I think what I've done is so much advocating for them, but I've never really thought about why they were the first four composers I chose. And they were, and I was really grateful that all of them jumped on board. You know, they're all, you know, I think what some people misunderstand about the project is because these composers are on the younger side, like around my age, people think, oh, it's sort of like a young composers contest, but it's not at all. I mean, these are all four composers who are getting commissions by major orchestras, but no one's risking it on them. So they're getting like 8 to 10 minute commissions, right? These like short little overtures and vignettes, and they're knocking them out of the park. And so my two criteria for picking a composer was, I need a composer who knows how to write for orchestra really well. I mean, it's a very, I mean, writing for 80 people on all the different instruments at the same time is one of the hardest skills for a composer. And I wasn't going to take a chance on that. Like, they had to show me that they could write incredibly well for the orchestra, an understanding of the instruments, the colors of the orchestra, and that they had developed kind of a unique sound when they write for orchestra. So that was kind of like my first criteria, because I didn't want someone trying to figure out how to do that on the go.
Right.
But then, and then the idea of, can they write long form? Or should I say, I want to hear what they have to say in long form. You know, so if they've done these great 10-minute pieces, I had to have a sense that they could tell their narrative over a 30 to 40 minute piece. And so those were the two things I was looking for. And of course, at the end of the day, I wanted four composers who are very different. And so, you know, we have Matt Brown is this weekend. He's a composer I probably met about 7 years ago through actually a composer's contest in Milwaukee, where I was conducting sort of the composers that had been chosen to be a part of this project. And so he and I got to know each other over there, fell in love with his music, had been really looking for a chance to work with him again. And so he was definitely on my radar right away. And Matt, for me, is sort of the big ideas composer, which is perfect for the symphony. He has so much character in his music, but also he's so genuine in how he in how he writes. Like, all he wants to do is communicate. And, you know, as a young composer, when I was growing up, and actually I went to college as a composition major and then decided this isn't for me. but I know, like, that mindset. I know what it is to go through all of that. And there is, it's very easy as a composer to feel pressured into having a voice. Because, you know, when we think of the great composers like Beethoven and Brahms and Stravinsky, you know, there's always like, oh, well, this composer was this. And we forget that those composers weren't thinking about that at all. They were trying to just communicate something with their music. But it's very easy as a composer nowadays to feel like you have to put a stamp on every one of your pieces. And ultimately, all that does is kill your creativity. So if you take yourself, basically, if you take yourself too seriously, it is not a good thing. And Matt is the kind of composer that he doesn't care what it takes. He wants to tell you his story. And so, like, the piece we did, the two pieces I conducted in the fall by him were was a piece called How the Solar System Was Won, which is this hilarious and fun and kind of ethereal homage to 2001 Space Odyssey.
Okay.
And so it's just, it starts off with kind of all these like creepy sounds that you might have heard in that movie, but ultimately it's also about kind of the forming of the universe. And so it ends up like what I like to call is like space rock and roll in the middle, where the orchestra's like just jamming away and you're like, what am I hear? Like, at that point, you're like, what am I even hearing?
Yeah.
And then I did another piece by him called Barnstorming Season, which was about trick pilots in the 1920s. And the the most popular form of American music at that time was ragtime. And so, you know, this is Matt for you. He the piece is going on, and it's quite rugged when it first starts off. Like, you hear the motors of the planes taking off, and there's, you know, and what he was trying to create is the sense of awe that people had in the 20s seeing airplanes fly over them, because this was a very new phenomenon.
Yeah.
And so the piece kind of zips around and goes crazy. But then there's like this moment where, like, you know, in his mind, it's like the planes like go above the clouds, and like you see like the beautiful sky. And in that moment, it's like everything evaporates, and it's like ragtime, like actual like honky tonk clarinet with piano ragtime. I remember the first time I heard the piece, because I burst out laughing. And people do. When they hear it, everybody just kind of chuckles, because it's so fun and it's so funny. And that's Matt for you. Like, he just has this childlike wonder in the way he approaches his music, and it's contagious. And I what's been amazing this weekend, and I couldn't have told you until literally this week, is that he has now, in this epic work, which is called The Course of Empire, and is based on a series of paintings that basically show the rise and fall of, in this case, kind of like a Roman Empire, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And he's taken this narrative and turned it into a symphony of just incredible proportions, and sort of the same thing where he is so intent about the characters that he creates in his music that it's just a wonderfully immersive experience. And everything that he's done in this piece, from like these opening kind of rugged moments where it's like hunter-gatherer phase of humanity, And it almost like the opening has like qualities like Jurassic Park almost in my mind, which is like my favorite film score. So I mean that as like the highest compliment. And then just, you know, like, and then these just kind of like rugged wild dances, and then this like beautiful pastoral, and then of course for like the military parade, which is sort of like the height of empire, if you will, he just goes for this kaleidoscopic look at patriotic music. And so we're just like whizzed around between like Sousa marches to like Dixieland, you know, to military fanfares, and you're just like, it's just like one insane parade where everyone is like talking and chattering at the same time, and it's fun, it's sarcastic, I mean it's just absolutely brilliant. And then you see kind of the demise of that empire right at its like height, and then it's so everything that he's done in this piece has just been exactly what a symphony needs to be. It's pulled us into his world, and in a way that only a big piece like this can do, we really get to be a part of this whole story.
I love that. I can't wait to hear it this afternoon. So what's interesting to me hearing you share that story is before we turned on the mic, you mentioned that you don't really consider yourself a storyteller. And it's interesting that like, almost every word or every descriptor used to tell that story or to talk about that piece has nothing to do really with the notes. You're talking about the story that it's telling.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if like, do you think about the pieces that you're conducting, like the actual music, do you think about the story that that music is telling? And maybe that can kind of connect to like when you're going to conduct a piece, how important it is to understand the story, the context with which it was written, to conduct it the best you can.
Yeah. No, it's so funny now, because I like a whole new like section of my mind has opened up, because I guess I always thought of like a storyteller as the person that creates the story. Which obviously that wouldn't be me in this case. Like I helped tell the story, but someone else has created that story. But then it occurred to me, like, you know, so many of the great like stories, like you think of like Homer's Odyssey or something, right? It was like, it was an oral tradition. And now that I think about it, I think that's very much how music works. Because when I go to conduct a Beethoven symphony that's, you know, 200 years old, there's a tradition that's been built up over the years, because Beethoven only can put so much information about how to perform his music. And so over the years, you know, there's been traditions, and sometimes we break those traditions, but we're always aware of them, about how to do a certain phrase, like how to perform this piece, how, you know, these various things are done. And it's almost like an oral tradition that's kind of passed on, so that by the time I'm doing this Beethoven symphony, it's kind of a a mashup of my own experiences. I've seen other conductors do it, of listening to old recordings, you know, of all of that, and like my own childhood, you know, growing up with these pieces, like everything gets kind of mashed together. And then that's, and then my vision kind of comes out of that for how to do a piece. So it is, it is incredibly important to kind of under that, that. I guess that's why it is important to understand the story that is around these pieces, you know. And in Matt's case, it doesn't, you know, I'm good friends with him, and the piece, you know, he can tell me what the piece is right there.
Right.
Where it gets a lot more difficult is when you're approaching, oh, you know what a great example is like this week is opening with Beethoven's Third Leonore Overture, which the reason I put it on this program is I wanted our audience to think about how fragile the creative process is. Because okay. Sometimes we take things for granted, like, oh, Beethoven was always great, right? His music was always great.
Hmm.
But by playing this overture, just a little hint of reminding people that Beethoven wrote a first Leonore overture and then he scrapped it. And then he wrote a second Leonore overture and then he scratched it. And then he wrote the third one, which we're playing. But by the time he wrote the third one, it was so large and epic that it turns out it was too big for the opera that he was trying to write it for. And so actually the final one is the Fidelio overture to his opera Fidelio. But he had three tries at an overture to this opera before he even got to the final one.
And why is that an important message for you to deliver?
Just to show like the musical process, to show how these amazing composers create and how they think and how they're always tinkering with things that are far beyond any of our own comprehension, you know, because they're the only ones that know what they're trying to say with their piece. And so Beethoven felt so strongly about this opera. It was the only opera he ever wrote, you know, and it had such important, it was such an important storyline to him, you know, this whole story about this, oppressed prisoners and the kind of the evil warden that is kind of keeping them down. All of Beethoven's music, you know, is about the human spirit, the resilience of the human spirit. And so this opera was his way of also telling that story, like he did with, you know, the Ode to Joy symphony, quite frankly.
Mm-hmm.
But this is an opera about that idea. And you can see in the overtures, he's so intense about it. And so I have to understand like the storyline of what Beethoven is trying to do. And so the opening of Leonore 3 is actually really the closest thing to the entire opera packed into an overture,
okay.
Which is why he discarded it in the end, because it was too close to the opera. But this overture in its scope just covers all of the ideas of like the darkness of the prisoners in these dark cells. But then kind of the resilience of the human spirit that comes out of that. But just an example of how that might affect how like I present the piece,
for
instance, is that there's these sharp, the opening is very slow. It's very slow. It's very dark. But it opens with like a very sharp, strong chord in the orchestra. And that reoccurs at a few points in this opening. And you have two choices to make. You can, you might think, well, you want the music to be cohesive. And if it's slow and melodic, maybe these chords, you know, they should have more of kind of like a bah sound, you know, instead of, you know, they shouldn't be too sharp so that they kind of have weight. And, you know, maybe you think of these heavy chords as being like I don't know, like in deep sorrow or something, you know. And so that might be one way to look at it. You know, for me, where this opera is headed is the warden is going to execute these prisoners.
Hmm.
And so for me, I go for the reverse, which is this gorgeous, dark music. And then these, like, almost like an executioner, like a gunshot, all these chords. And so that's how I do the opening. And I want people to jump out of their seats at the first chord. And instead of this getting kind of like this wah sound, they just get this hack in the orchestra that opens up the piece.
Mm.
And, you know, that's like a storytelling thing for me. You know, it's like,
yeah.
I think, you know, and both options would be right. There are certainly many famous conductors that have interpreted it as this much kind of bigger sound and not as violent. You know, but for me, that has been, and it's been great to see the orchestra kind of understand what I'm trying to do, you know, and really deliver these shockingly brutal chords in the opening of this piece, which I think sets the tone for, you know, really what this opera is that there's a violent undertone.
At what point are you making that decision? Are you making that decision once you get into the rehearsal space and you hear the whole symphony playing the piece and you go, I just, that part is not popping the way I want it to? Or are you sitting at your desk at home and you're like looking at the sheet music, I don't know, singing it in your head, mm-hmm. or like, when are you making these decisions? Like, how does that come up?
It sort of depends on what the decision is that you're trying to make. I don't like to premeditate too much of what I'm going to do. Again, it's a very much a personal thing. I've worked with great conductors that have a very precise vision of every single thing in the piece, and they are brilliantly able to convey that to an orchestra and convince them to do it exactly the way they want them to do it. I have also worked, though, with some great conductors who I think I am closer to, who they like to respond to their musicians. So they do have a vision, but they also walk into rehearsal and they want to meld with the orchestra. And I find that much more fun, because if I don't want to conduct the same piece the same way all the time. Mm-hmm. And what keeps it fresh for me is knowing what I'm trying to say with the piece, but maybe saying it differently depending on the orchestra, depending on how they play. Mm-hmm. So for something like this, like how violently I want those chords played at the opening, that's a much more premeditated thing, because, you know, I don't know when that would have happened, but, you know, I would have been at my desk at some point, but just going through it in my head and just knowing, you know, the history of the piece and also knowing other performances of it. And, I can't remember. Oh yeah. One of my favorite Beethoven conductors. That's right. That's where I got this idea from. One of my favorite Beethoven conductors, is Harnoncourt. It's just, I actually passed away recently, just brilliant, early music conductor. And he would perform music on period instruments, and, which basically means, you know, instruments in Beethoven's time, they couldn't play as loudly as instruments today, but which also means you could play them more forcefully and it wouldn't be like, it wouldn't just obliterate everything. Okay. It's kind of hard to describe, but in other words, like horns and trumpets in Beethoven's era would have had much more of a snarl to them. They weren't as beautiful of an instrument as they are now.
I get what you're saying, yeah.
And the timpani, you know, the drums back then, they weren't always perfectly in tune. They were kind of rough and raw around the edges. And so when Harnoncourt does this overture, and that was my inspiration, when he did it, it was these just colossal violent hits in the orchestra that were ugly. You know, because the trumpets and the horns just kind of like, he just had them just like blast in their instruments. And if you did that on modern instruments, it would just be too loud, you know, but instead there, it's like, it just kind of overloads on those instruments and you just get this like really angry snarl, and the timpani sounds like a gunshot. You know, it's very dead sound. It doesn't have a lot of reverberation to it. And so these are all things that we can approximate in a modern orchestra. And so that's why it's so important that I have a vision of that coming in, because then I can describe like what we're trying to get. And these musicians know what a period ensemble would sound like. Okay. And so they know when I explain what I'm going for in that kind of sound, they can approximate that on modern instruments. So,
Very cool.
Yeah, it sort of depends. But, you know, other things like the tempos that I've chosen, I definitely adjusted those.
Okay.
You know, I had actually wanted, not really here nor there. If we can't hear a recording of me doing it, the speed of the piece, that often changes because it's clarity. You know, so if I want to hear a melody really clear, maybe I just need to slow it down like a tick. Mm. And so often, you know, in my head, everything is always perfectly clear. But when I try to translate that to the orchestra, sometimes I'll be like, whoa, I'm going way too fast. Because if I go this fast, you're not hearing the detail I want. Mm. So usually it's too fast. Rarely am I too slow. Usually in my head, everything sounds great when it's really fast. And then I have to tailor that to make sure that the audience hears the music clearly.
So you've mentioned working with great conductors, or you mentioned that he was a brilliant Beethoven conductor. In a general sense, what do you think makes a great conductor? What qualities?
Oh, man. It is really, conducting has got to be one of the strangest professions in the music world, because we don't make any sound. And because of that, you know, it's even, you know, I always think of like music in general as kind of like ice skating in the Olympics, where they try to give a number to the ice skaters, mm-hmm. and you're like, but it's totally like, unless they fell, it's entirely subjective. And it's the same thing with musicians. Unless they missed a note, it becomes very subjective after that. But as subjective as that is, then imagine a conductor who doesn't even, we don't miss notes. We don't make any music. Like, how do you judge a conductor? because everything we do is more or less interpretation, assuming that we, you know, do our technique correctly, like assuming we move our arms in the right way and assuming the orchestra plays together and all those good things, then it becomes incredibly kind of like, well, how much of it was the conductor and how much was the orchestra? And, you know, and like for the top orchestras in the world, you know, any conductor would look amazing in front of them. And I really mean that. You know, it may not have the same force of a conductor that walked in there and had the respect of the musicians and knew what they wanted to do.
Right.
But it would be an amazing concert, like the Berlin Philharmonic. You could pretty much throw any conductor up there, and as long as they didn't mess with it, it would sound incredible. Mm-hmm. Because they are just, these are the best musicians in the world, and they know exactly what they're trying to do, and it just happens. So it's a long way of saying that it gets to be very difficult to try to figure out what makes a great conductor. But I think ultimately it's something that's felt by the musicians. Like, you just sense it. And what can make a great conductor with one orchestra could make them a terrible conductor with another orchestra. That's the other thing. But
what do you mean by that?
You know, just like it can be a personality clash. You know, some orchestras they have the personality that they want to work. They want a conductor that like nitpicks and fixes things. And like, you know, they might want a conductor like that. And so a conductor that comes in is sort of like a big picture conductor and expects the orchestra to kind of do the little things on their own. They might not like that as much. But then there's also those orchestras that are like, let us handle the details. Show us the big picture. Show us kind of the wider angle view on what's happening. And like I said, there can be great conductors on both sides, but I think there's a charisma when they get up there and you want to, they have a way of just without saying anything, you know, they're not beaten down on the musicians or anything, but there's just a sense about when they conduct, there's a gravitas and a understanding that quickly you can see the musicians be like, okay, great.
Yeah.
Like we know what we need to see. And you know, and I feel it too with me sometimes, because, you know, if I show up to an orchestra that doesn't know me, they're always going to be skeptical, and mm-hmm. rightly they should be,
who's
you know,
this guy?
But especially, you know, when you're still young and you show up there, it's like, you know, we get it from like the New York Phil, they're looking at you like, really, really, like, what is this kid going to be able to do? And you know, it's interesting to watch an orchestra relax once they realize that you're a musician. You're just doing your job. You're not trying to show off. You're not trying to impress. You're just trying to help us all make great music together. Mm. And it's great to always feel, and maybe that's what it is. Maybe at the bottom line is, because every conductor personality is different, we all look different. We all talk different. I mean, we all cover the entire spectrum of what a leader could be. And yet the one thing I think that ties it all together is we're able to keep the focus on the music, on making great music. And that, I mean, that's always my goal.
Yeah.
And I think I was lucky to work with great conductors that they reminded me that that is the ultimate goal. Like, we may know their names, you know, but ultimately they're thinking about Beethoven and Brahms, you know, they're thinking about the great composers. They're not thinking about like their whole thing. They're not up in their own heads. They're focused on the music.
I love that. I keep thinking of like the analogy of being a conductor of a symphony to being like the director of a movie. One thing that strikes me as very different in what you just said is like, in the same way you know, in fictional movies, you'll probably have a screenwriter who is kind of like Matt. He wrote the screenplay.
Yeah.
And then you have the director who takes that and creates the vision of how that's going to come to life. But one big difference is that, like, for you to get this job, like, you showed up to what was already here.
Yeah.
The concert hall is here. The orchestra is pretty much here. Whereas the director of a movie is like choosing the pieces to come together that fit his or her vision.
Yeah.
And so, like, what is a way when you step into an orchestra and a culture that's already set here, how do you gain respect and then use that respect to kind of shape the creative vision that you have?
Yeah. It's been, you know, it's been a long process for me, and I'm sure I still have a lot to figure out. I mean, I've been a music director. I'm now in my third season of being a music director anywhere. So there's been a lot to start to try to just learning on the fly. Like every week, a new problem comes up or something comes up where I'm learning to kind of deal with that. I think I've become a lot more comfortable with who I am and how I work. And I think the hardest thing, honestly, is right off the bat, you know, you want everyone to like you. That's the first thing, you know. And you know, when you're a young conductor just starting off, your first job is as an assistant conductor.
Okay.
So like it's basically like a very nice, it's like a paid internship. You know, you're brought there, you are the backup, and you're the assistant to all the guest conductors and the music director that come through. So you're basically there to back them up. You know all the music. You're ready to step in at the last second. But also if they need anything during the week, you're kind of just there for them. And so you get to learn a lot from them. So it works out very well. But the other thing is you get along really well with the musicians because you're not their boss.
Right.
Like you're on like their boss is your boss. And it's really good in many ways because as a young conductor, you need to know what they're thinking when various conductors come through, and they'll tell you who they like, who they don't like, why they screwed up, and you get to see conductors fail and succeed on a weekly basis. So you know there is all of that where you get to see what's working and what's not and what's not from all these conductors that are coming through. But also you're thinking, well, I can make everyone like me, you know, because you think you're seeing all the mistakes. And I think one of the hardest lessons to learn was you just need them to respect you and not like you. And in fact, if they sense that you're trying to make everyone like you, you'll lose respect really fast. And ultimately, that's kind of what I realized is as long as I keep the focus on the music and I create, I love to work collaboratively. So, you know, I come in with a very strong vision, but I work with my musicians closely. I want to, you know, if they have a strong feeling about something, we figure it out how to make it work. I expect that kind of give and take in rehearsal, that I'm not sitting there just, you know, saying like, it has to be this way, but more like, you know, I'm trying to create this character. How do we do that? Like, what do we have to do to get there as a group? And so that's always been sort of my way of working. But also now that I'm a music director, you have to build over time. I mean, that's one of the big challenges. You know, as a guest conductor, you come in, you take what's there in front of you, you have a very nice week. The musicians generally will get along with you because they know you're going to be gone in a week.
Yeah.
You know, but being a music director, you're expected to push the orchestra. That is you know what their bar is.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is you raise it every single concert, every single time you work with them, you take another step up. And so I think this has been the training for me is to kind of learn to set the bar for like, this is how we need to play. We need to play this well. We need to focus on these things. And how do we continue to achieve that and then move beyond those basic ideas? So you can be demanding if it's about the right things.
Yeah.
I think that's what I'm discovering. And if it's demanding about we collectively as a whole need to do this, I think that's a big help. And then also, quite frankly, I think there's, and maybe going back to, you know, what makes a great conductor, now that I'm thinking about it, is there's a visible, like people sense that you are a relentless perfectionist. In other words, that you are harder on yourself than you would ever be on anybody else. And I let my musicians see that. Like if I make a mistake, like I don't mind being visibly frustrated at myself. And I want them to know that like as high as a bar I set for all of you, I hold myself to a higher bar. You know, for as much effort as you're putting in, I'm going to put more effort in. And I think I like to set that tone that, and I think a lot of conductors, you know, do that in their own way. But just that the kind of subtle reminder that, you know, yes, it's my job to push us. And that is my position here is to kind of set the quality control. Like this is how we need to play. This is how we need to perform. But also I hold myself to an even higher standard than that. And so I think that's part of commanding that respect is just, you know, not being afraid to, I don't know, it's just not being afraid to just be yourself and that, you know, they're all perfectionists. All musicians are perfectionists in one way or another. And but to also let, you know, just have those moments where you're able to show them that, you know, we're human too, and we make mistakes. But we're also, you understand that your role is unique, and that you have to, the bar that you set is something that you set for yourself first, and then everyone tries to reach it. So
totally.
Yeah. Still, you know, ask me again in a couple of years, and hopefully I'll have some new ideas. But, you know, like I said, every challenge presents a new opportunity for me to figure out how to navigate the personalities and how to get the best out of the group. And I know for a lot of conductors that can be frustrating. I love it. I love knowing that I could make I can make someone want to be a better musician. I mean, that idea to me is just incredible. That, you know, when I look at a player, when I interact with them, I can give them confidence. I can actually make them a better orchestra musician just by our interactions and how the rehearsal process can go. And I think that's the best feeling in the world when you realize that you have created something that's better than, you know, each part of it, that the sum has become something much greater. It's a very cool feeling.
That's so cool. And I put down a note in my notebook here that's been coming up as like a theme throughout our conversation. And I have a little star next to it, and it just has the words creative space. And I think that in any creative arts, and I think of storytelling as, you know, a documentarian who wants to be working on teams to make kick-ass documentaries, and who works in teams in a lot of capacities. I also do improv theater when I'm consistently like working as a team. I think there's this such a fascinating balance between when you give people like creative space. Like, for example, you were talking about Matt, and you were saying how a lot of composers these days don't have the space to just go write music. Or here you're talking about being in rehearsal. You don't show up just with your vision and make everyone force everyone to go into that. You come, show up, are present, and see what's there. You're allowing there to be space. But then there are also times when you're like, no, we need to do this. And I think striking that balance of giving people space to express themselves and go inward versus when you need to be a little bit more strict with that vision to lead the team. I think that's just like a fascinating balance that all storytellers and creatives like will face.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, there's nothing scary when you think about it, to, you know, throwing 80 musicians on stage, all of whom have the right to have a vision of a piece of music, right? Everyone has put in the work.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's incredible, actually, that we can do what we do, you know, that we can all band together and listen to each other. And, you know, this is why, you know, music education is one of my big passions. The other thing that I like about being a music director, again, you know, I can't advocate if I'm just the conductor, but when I'm music director, you know, we have, you know, 5 youth ensembles that work under the Santa Rosa Symphony, as well as a lot of like in-school programs and programs for schools to come to the hall to hear the orchestra. And I get to put priorities on those. Like I get to, you know, do development for those programs. I get to interact with those students and like inspire them. And, you know, I get to actually set priority on those sorts of things that you wouldn't be able to do otherwise. And what I talk to those kids about is the unbelievable skill they're building by being in an orchestra, because you're not only working on a high technical level, just playing your instrument, right? But you have to interpret all the music you're seeing, like all the directions, how loud to play, how soft to play, how short or long to play, and what note to play, right? All that's going by in real time. And then you're listening. You have to listen all around you to the people that are right next to you, as well as listening to the people who are far away from you. And you're having to watch the conductor and watch your colleagues, depending on the moment and whichever you need to be doing. And so, you know, in milliseconds of time, you are rotating between all those 4 things constantly. And that's the only way to be able to play an orchestra well. And I mean, if those aren't some of the most important skills you need in just life in general, like that kind of self-awareness and flexibility and listening, I mean, that is what we all need in our lives. And I love the fact that just by playing a musical instrument, young people are building those kind of core skills that they need. You know, it's not about being a professional musician. It's about being successful in life.
Absolutely.
And so it's a really remarkable thing. And then when you take that to the professional level, that's where it really is stunning, like how an orchestra is able to play the music that we do together, and just the amount of of skill that's going out on the stage at any given moment is really incredible. And I like to highlight that. You know, I don't like to, I don't want our concerts to just feel like entertainment. You know, it should feel like a trapeze act because it is.
Yeah, totally. So you've mentioned that you're trying to get youth involved both in ensembles, but I know that you also have an emphasis on trying to get youth who may not even be in an ensemble to care about the symphony and mm-hmm. come to the symphony. Why do you think that classical music or symphonies are a little bit more challenging to access for youth? I mean, I'm not, it's rare that I'm scrolling through Instagram stories and I'm seeing like my friends at the symphony. Like, so why do you think that is? And what are some efforts that you're making to try to change that?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it honestly has been self-inflicted. I'm not concerned at all about kind of the music world going forward. I think we were a little bit slow to the party as far as realizing that people aren't always going to come to us. You know, culture changes, people change. You know, technology has come into play in the past 20 years in a way that we never could have expected. And orchestras have just, you know, we're big organizations and change sometimes happens slowly. And it takes people at the top to really make that change happen. And, you know, up until maybe, you know, 20 years ago, you know, a young conductor would have been a bad thing. Almost all music directors were older. And of course, now the cool thing is young conductors. But part of it is because we do have an understanding and we know we need to move our orchestras in directions just to make them more accessible. You know, one of the fascinating things to me people will say, oh, well, our audiences are getting older, you know, in the hall, our audiences are getting older. And oh my God, you know, what's going to happen when they die? Like, there's not going to be any new people coming to the concert hall. Well, the funny thing is if you go back, like in the 70s, the New York Times wrote an article saying all the audiences are getting older in the concert hall. What's going to happen when they die? Well, clearly, you know, I'm not sure if it's a matter of them dying. It's like it's just like there's an age bracket where it becomes easier to subscribe to the symphony. And I think that's fine.
Is that like just financially?
Time-wise. I mean, if you have kids and they haven't gone to college yet, you're going to be pretty tired. You know, like you're not going to want to be going to concerts constantly.
Right.
And just like, you know, people in general aren't going to the arts. And you know, in a concert, an orchestra concert or any classical music concert is a commitment. You know, it's not like, hey, let's go to the art museum on a Sunday afternoon and just kind of walk around and I can look at the things I like. I don't have to look at the things I don't like and I can get out of there. You know, when you come into an orchestra concert, it is an event. You are putting your phone away. You are disconnecting from the outside world and you are dedicating yourself to this moment. And I think that's actually something that people should talk more about. I think it's a really beautiful thing. And I think it's becoming more and more important in society that we have places like this. I mean, I can't even, you know, even on a plane now, you use your phone. You know, like the one spot where I used to have peace and quiet now on an airplane, even now I don't get peace and quiet then, you know? And so the concert hall is becoming the last place where people aren't trying to snap selfies during the concert, you know? And it's like, and I think that's a good thing. You know, people are like, oh, maybe you'll bring more young people in if you let them use their cell phones. And I was like, no, because then we just become like every other place. And I think what makes us special is it is the only chance to get away from all of that. And so I kind of highlight that on the other end. As far as getting young people in, it's not the art form itself, obviously. I mean, if you look at the number of young people who are loving playing in, you know, youth orchestra or just love listening to music. And, you know, there's never a single person that I talk to that when they find out what I do, you know, they're not like, oh, really? Like that? You know, I mean, people are like, that's amazing. I totally want to come check it out.
Do people ask you if you conduct trains? Is that, do people sometimes think that?
I suppose, I think I've learned to put orchestra conductor before when I say, yeah. but yeah, you know, there's such an excitement around the art. Like no one doesn't want to go to the symphony. Let's put it that way. Yeah. Right. So the main thing is giving them a reason. And I think a lot of that is in the environment around our concerts. So one of the things I'm working very hard on is to emphasize the community aspect of what we do. That when you come to a concert, you come because of the people. You know, because otherwise, why? You know, you could stay in your house. You don't have to deal with the person next to you who's coughing. You don't have to deal with the person who smells bad next to you. Basically, if you stay at home with your fancy sound system, you get to do whatever you want. So why would you go to a live concert? Mm. Well, I think it's because of all the other people. Because when you put everyone in that room like that, and you are visually and viscerally connected to what is going on stage, that's where these incredible transformative moments happen. And that's what happened this weekend with this brand new symphony is, you know, I went out on stage and I said, you know, this is the most important act any orchestra and an audience can do together. And it's been going on for 300 years. And that is experiencing and bringing to life a new work of music. And we do it together, not just the musicians on stage, not just me, not just Matt. It's all of us together in this room right now. And, you know, just reminding them, like, you are a part of making this happen. Like, every concert, it's a two-way street where the energy goes back and forth, where the intensity is felt in the entire room. And those moments when people realize how spectacular it is and what they're seeing and what they're witnessing, then there's an excitement around the audience that I think is really becoming palpable here. I have to say, it's been really wonderful to see our audiences here in Santa Rosa just kind of let loose. I mean, they get so excited for things. I mean, Matt got just a huge standing ovation for his symphony because people realized this is a moment in history. It'll never happen again. Like, yeah. Right, this piece in this moment, it will never be the same. And that, you know, and we don't need to hide behind that. It's an amazing thing that we're able to do something like this and come together and be a part of creating a new work of art that's on the scale of like building a house, you know. And I think that's the difference between just saying, oh, well, here's this like 6-minute piece we commissioned by a composer, is sort of like asking for like a miniature watercolor. Right. And, you know, what we've asked for is a mural the size of a building, you know. And there's a total different way that we interact with a work of art of that size. And that's what we saw this weekend. And I think for young people, they are craving those experiences. And my hope is that they'll feel more and more comfortable just coming to the hall, being who they are, and realizing that the cool thing to do nowadays is put that phone away and interact with each other and interact with some music and talk about it. And, you know, what I love is with a lot of young people that are starting to come to concerts, like, I'll see them at the bars afterwards, you know. Well, people don't realize, like, we're musicians, man. We like to go out afterwards.
Yeah.
And, you know, nothing makes me more happy than when I end up in, like, a bar or a restaurant after a concert and, like, people were at the concert, you know. And there's, like, their whole idea of, like, this barrier between the orchestra and the audience, it kind of falls away finally, you know. And I think that's really important, that we don't have that separation. Yeah. And that there's much more interaction between all of us.
Amazing. Before we wrap up, Francesco, where can I send people if they want to follow you or follow your work? What direction should we point them in?
I have professional pages on social media, which I'm horrible about using. But
that's how we got in touch. You saw my tweet.
Yeah,
it's true.
It's true. It only took me like 2 months. I really struggle with it. I think I'm like right on the cusp of the generation that really got into social media. And so when I put a post up, it takes me like 30 minutes to put one post up. Whereas, you know, I see these kids, you know, they can throw up like 20 posts in a day. And I don't know how they do it. So for me, it's a labor of love, but I try to put up like key things. So you can find me on Facebook, Instagram. Probably those are the two best to find me on. And of course, I have my website, which is just aleche-chong.com. That's more for my concert schedule.
Cool.
Otherwise, you know, definitely follow the Santa Rosa Symphony online. I mean, their social media accounts are much better than mine. they come and they do video interviews with me. So you can see a lot more interviews with me about the programs we're doing. You can get snippets of me in rehearsal footage. So in many ways, if you really want to see the special stuff that's going on here, check out the Santa Rosa Symphony. If you're up in Oregon and you're listening to this, yep, Check out the Eugene Symphony.
And then you do guest conducting occasionally around the country, right?
Yeah, and wherever else I end up being. But it's very, I'm very fortunate to have, you know, some great platforms to share kind of my love for what I do.
I love it. And for those listening, I'll put links to those in the show notes so you can check them out. And Francesco, the final question for today's show, what I end every show on, is asking one last bit of advice that you have for people who want to become better storytellers. And we can make that even broader for better storytellers, creatives, or yeah, even conductors.
You know, when I think about that, I think of like some of the most difficult stories, I guess, that I have to tell, you know, which would, you know, there are like Mahler symphonies that are 90 minutes long, right? Like 90 minutes without stopping. And it's something that you have to comprehend on a large scale. And the funny thing about, you know, when I sometimes I conduct like without score by memory, and people are always like really impressed. But, you know, honestly, it's a part of learning the score. Like the idea is you should know the score so well that you could conduct it by memory. But it's even more important in like a large scale work. Like if it's 90 minutes long, I don't want to be stuck turning, you know, 500 pages during those 90 minutes. I want it all in my head so that I know where I am in like kind of the larger picture of the piece. And I think when I'm building that story per se, the best thing that I do is always start way ahead of time. I know as creatives, great. I procrastinate.
Yeah,
so does
too.
Everybody. Mm-hmm. And but the best thing you can do is it's not about starting, you know, like start. It's not that I start studying a score 9 months before the concert or even a year before a concert, but it's like that's when you start putting the work into it, but also that you knowing that you'll need space from it. Because what I find is you almost have to simulate the fact that you like perform a piece, put it away, pick it back up, put it away, pick it back up, and put it away. Because that's how you get better. Like that's how I get better at conducting a piece of music, is by performing it more often. But if I'm doing something for the first time, I have to simulate that process in my head. So, you know, I'll spend, you know, a couple weeks studying a score intensely, get it to the point where it's like, I could get through it. Wouldn't be a great performance, but I could get through it. And then I put it away. And then I'll come back to it maybe even like a month later, you know, and hit it again. And I'll find ton more detail in it suddenly, because you took it to the next level, like finding smaller tidbits, things that stand out to you, you know, more detail that you want to bring out when you do the piece. You do that for like a week, put it away again, you know, bring it back. So having that time, I think, is the most important thing. I used to think that, well, I'm going to procrastinate anyway, so why should I open up the score earlier? Mm-hmm. And I think the reason is you want to get it moving around in your head. And then ultimately at the end of the day, like, do I procrastinate? Oh, hell yeah. Like a week before the concert, I go into lockdown mode, you know? And then suddenly it's like, but the key thing is I've laid the groundwork so that when I go into like, you know, this symphony is my whole life for like 8 hours a day, I've laid down though a lot of groundwork. And I think that's really important. So the procrastination is more on a like focus level, but it's not on like, I've never seen this piece before and I'm trying to learn it in a week.
Yeah.
Instead, it's like, this is my last chance now. And this week I need to live this piece day in and day out. And it's only, I'm only allowed to do that by the process before. And I don't know how that translates to other storytelling,
I think it absolutely does.
Of going and walking away and going and walking away.
Absolutely.
And then you can procrastinate at the end if you so choose.
No, I think that's fantastic. Fantastic tactical advice for any creative, for any storyteller out there. Beautiful. Well, I can't wait to see the show this afternoon.
That was wonderful to meet you, Austin.
Francesco, thanks so much for joining the show.
Yeah, thank you.
That's it for episode 35 of the Austin Meyer Podcast. Thank you to Francesco for joining the podcast and to you for listening. What do you think of the conversation? What were some takeaways for you? You can reach out to me at Austin Meyer Films on Instagram and Facebook, or send an email to austinmeyerfilms@gmail.com. I would love to hear what you're feeling, what you thought of the show. I always love to hear from listeners. And if you're enjoying the show, please consider leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. To be honest, I don't really know a ton about the algorithm or what it does, but I'm told that it really helps the show's visibility. And I'd love to spread the word about the amazing storytellers like Francesco who are coming on the show to share their wisdom. And lastly, if you want to hear more about the overlap between telling stories through music and other mediums, I recorded a bonus episode this week on the Austin Meyer Private Podcast talking about how playing mandolin has helped me become a better documentarian. To get access to that and other bonus episodes and post shows with our guests, all you have to do is head on over to patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. That is Patreon, patreon.com/AustinMeyerFilms. And for as little as $2 a month, you can get access to the private podcast feed and help keep the mics on around here. That's it for episode 35. Thanks again for being here, everyone. And I will see you on the next episode. Until then, go out and tell some stories.